This is Digital Story Podcast number 600, September 5th, 2017. Today's theme is Six Ways That Photography Has Changed. I'm Derek Story. I was composing a shot at the Santa Monica Metro station the other night when I felt someone staring at me. I looked up and saw this man at the top of the steps with his eyes directly fixed on me. I looked back for a moment and waited for him to say something. Finally, he spoke. "Were you taking my picture?" he asked. This is the type of encounter that I'm experiencing more and more these days. And for our 600th show, I thought I would explore six ways that photography has changed since I started this podcast in 2005. Meanwhile, back at the Santa Monica Metro station, I paused for a moment before answering the man who had been glaring at me. His body was stiff with anger. I took a deep breath, exhaled, and replied, "I've been taking pictures here for about an hour. If you've been here during that time, you may be in some of them. I couldn't tell you for sure. But you have not been the subject of my work." "That's freaking uncool," he spit out. "You should be ashamed of yourself." He kept staring at me. "I'm sorry I bothered you," I replied, "but that wasn't my intent." I then walked away without saying anything else. There was nothing to add to the story. I put my camera away and walked back to the hotel. The night was over. I started thinking about all the encounters that I've experienced while working recently and how much the act of photography has changed as well as its perception. Some things are better, many are not. And since we're at a milestone today, show number 600, this seems like a good time to take stock of the situation. So yes, we have six today instead of five to celebrate our 600th show. Oh my gosh. And I know some of you have been with me all that time, which is just as incredible as me actually doing 600 shows. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with some of the technical things here on this list, but then we're going to slowly evolve into some of the more social issues. And that's where we're going to end up, because I think as powerful as our cameras are today, I think what's happening socially with them or not happening with them is probably even more important. So let's start with the physical stuff here. And I think I'll start with the maturation of the digital workflow. So in 2005, the year I began this podcast, Aputure was released by Apple, with Lightroom soon to follow. So this was a next step in digital photography. This was a big step because it represented a true integrated raw workflow for all levels of photographers. Today we have all sorts of different software options, but we didn't then. I mean, a lot of it was just Photoshop and Bridge and sort of, you know, kind of hooking these different things together. To be able to open one app, to have digital asset management, to have raw decoding, and then to have a very nice set of image editing tools. And then when we were done making our pictures look pretty using these tools, we could output them in a variety of ways. Not just printing, but create web pages and all sorts of good stuff. All of this happened within one app. Aputure did it, Lightroom did it, others have followed. But I think for a lot of us who were just trying to hang in there on our computers, yes, I was using iPhoto some. Yes, I was using Photoshop and Bridge. Yes, I was doing all these sort of things. But I was in search of a solution, and Aputure and Lightroom provided those solutions. And that all happened about 2005. And I think for a lot of us, that brought some sanity to our photography, some organization, just some cohesiveness so that we could, you know, get back to thinking about taking pictures and not worry so much about this new digital workflow and how to manage it. So I think those were watershed moments, both Aputure and Lightroom, about the time that I started this show. Now, another thing that happened was increased resolution, capability, and storage. So now we're going to get into the truly physical stuff. On Flickr, I have this shot of my boys captured in April of 2005. They were playing basketball. It was just a great moment. It was a true dad thing where I was teaching them this thing that they did not know how to do, which was dribble, pass, and shoot a basketball. For those shots, I was using a Canon Rebel XT. So here's what Canon wrote about its camera at the time. The EOS Digital Rebel XT features Canon's 8.0 megapixel CMOS complementary metal oxide semiconductor sensor, which captures images of exceptional clarity and tonal range and offers the most pixels in its class. This, again, was the camera that I was using in 2005. It had a 1.8-inch LCD viewfinder with 115,000 dots of resolution. So a little postage stamp of an LCD viewfinder that also did not have very good resolution at all. So today, let's fast forward to where we are right now. I'm capturing always in the neighborhood of 20 megapixels, sometimes a little less, sometimes a bit more, but right around 20 megapixels with a 3-inch LCD, always about a million dots. Very nice screen on the back of the camera. Very impressive processors to go along with those sensors. So not only do we have more resolution, but we just have a better processing pipeline so that we can shoot burst mode. I mean, do you remember shooting raw burst mode with a Canon Rebel back in those days? I think it was like 3 shots or something like that. Video, not so much, right? If there was video, it wasn't very good. It was really different than it is right now. So the hardware has very much improved. And then at the same time, storage has become cheaper. In 2005, hard drives were relatively expensive and cloud storage was anything but robust and certainly not reliable, especially in the sense of businesses coming and going. So you think you found the solution and then they'd go out of business and then you'd have to do something else and recover from, whatever happened with the previous guys that you were working with. So today, I can buy 3 terabyte hard drives for about $90, and I have 200 gigabytes of cloud backup with iCloud for $2.99 a month. And all of this storage is optimized. So it's really an improved situation. Our capture devices are better. They capture more information, and physically, we can better manage that information because storage has decreased in price and really just increased in ability. So all of that is really good. Now, you combine all that I'm talking about with the improved digital workflow, and on that end of the spectrum, I think we're looking really good. And in a lot of ways, and we say this, right? We say this is the best time to be a photographer in terms of cameras and workflow and storage and all that good stuff. It's really a good time. The third point, more sharing options. This is where things really begin to change. And of course, we didn't realize it at the time, or at least I didn't realize it at the time. In 2004, both Facebook and Flickr launched. Twitter followed in 2006. We didn't see Instagram until 2010 and Snapchat until 2011. Now, the impact of these social networks has changed photography, in my mind, quite a bit, especially when you add the other things I'm going to talk about here in a moment. But let's just focus on the sharing options. So when Flickr came out, which for me was a big deal. Facebook, not so much in the beginning. I thought it was interesting, but Flickr, designed for photographers by people who really were passionate about photography, that was a big deal to me. The ability to share my images, not only with people that I wanted to see them, that I knew, but also allow other people to discover my photography, especially through the use of tags and other bits of metadata, Well, to me, that was just phenomenal. I just loved it. And I thought, this is going to change things. I was really excited about it because now a photographer who was really good, let's say, had a chance to be recognized as a really good photographer. Whereas if he or she had been born in a small town outside of media mainstream prior to Flickr, the odds of them becoming known, unless they actually moved to New York City, moved to Los Angeles, the odds of them becoming known and respected for what they could do, well, those odds were lower than now, in my mind, thanks to Flickr and what was to follow. So I thought this was a really wonderful thing, and the early days of Flickr were terrific, especially the days before Yahoo bought them. For me, it was all positive stuff. Now, there were always conversations about people stealing your pictures, but, you know, the fact of the matter is I was not putting high-resolution images on Flickr. In fact, in those days, I was probably putting 1024s on there. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to weigh the price of someone stealing my image against, you know, being anonymous. And I'll take the risk. I'll take the risk. And if they steal my shot, they got a 1024. I have the raw file. I thought it was basically all plus side. But then other things happened. And in addition to Facebook and Flickr and Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat, something else happened. And this was more of a cultural phenomenon, although I think it was spurred in large part by a device. And what I'm referring to is the emergence of the selfie. I think the emergence of the selfie has had a huge impact on photography in a lot of different ways. So the iPhone 4 was introduced in 2010, and it had a front-facing camera. And I think that this single device poured gas on the self-love portrait phenomenon known as the selfie. So you take this camera now that you were able to hold up and see yourself and get just the right angle and, you know, the most flattering lighting and all that kind of stuff. Take a picture of yourself with this device, and then this device was connected to, you know, all the social networking stuff that was going on so that you could get that picture in front of other people. And then, of course, you know, we had rating systems on all these things, so, and comments and all that. So then you could take a picture, get it out there, and then have people say, you know, how good you looked, how beautiful you were that day, how nice your hair was, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I think the tone of consumer photography shifted from this outward exploration of the world more to inward reassurance. And the convergence of social networking, which was now really starting to pick up steam, along with the iPhone 4 and the front-facing camera, and then, you know, whatever else was happening culturally at the time, suddenly the most popular shots on social networks weren't, you know, really truly artistic endeavors, or rarely were they artistic endeavors, but, you know, they were beautiful women showing, you know, lots of their body, nice smiles, perfect hair, big, beautiful made-up eyes, the whole deal. And less about, you know, the art of photography itself. So I was going, okay, this isn't exactly what I had planned. Now, obviously, if I were a beautiful, you know, 20-year-old at the time, I may have a different take on this. I really may. But I wasn't. You know, I wasn't. I'm actually much better behind the camera instead of in front of it. You guys have seen my pictures, right? I'm better behind the camera. It was more than just, I can't compete with a 20-year-old girl. I remember going to a conference. I think it was a web conference of some sort. This was back around this time. And this conference, for one of the speakers, brought this very attractive young woman up. I'm not going to say her name. A very attractive young woman up talking about how to get traction on social networks, because she had over 1 million followers. And so while she's talking, she's illustrating, you know, her talk with her images that she's posting online that got her a million followers or a million plus followers. And I'm sitting in the audience. I was actually attending this conference and I'm listening to her because I was interested. I'm always interested in how to improve my platform. I was, you know, going there with the attitude that I was going to learn something from her. And the pictures that were flowing up on this giant screen were her in all these different poses that she took herself. Wildly attractive, beautiful figure. We saw lots of her figure. And I'm going, well, if this is the way she got a million followers, then that's not going to work for me. You know what I mean? I cannot do that. It won't work. I will probably lose followers. You know what I mean? So I walked out of that session. I'm just going, I'm doomed. I really am doomed, because if this is what a legitimate conference is putting forward as a way to broaden your platform, I'm doomed. And, you know, some of the people in the room, that would work. And I'm sure her tips would help. But for me, it wouldn't. And at that moment, that was sort of a watershed moment for me, saying that, okay, things are going to be changing for me. I can feel it now. And I was very right about that. I was very right about that. So I think that the emergence of the selfie, iPhone 4, and the sharing options, the social networks, that all sort of happened in the same time frame, had a big impact on photography, maybe a bigger impact than many of us realized at the time. Now we get to the fifth point, which is what I call the devaluation of artistic imagery. And this is somewhat related, but somewhat tangential also. With the improved hardware and software, really little ability was required to create a technically acceptable photograph. Most people now could take a technically acceptable photograph. We may just take that for granted now, but before all of this happened, learning your craft, learning how to technically capture an image, was a big part of photography. And that was part of our experience. So as we were out learning how to become technically adept, other parts of our photography improved also, the aesthetic part, the artistic part, all those sort of things, because we were out there doing stuff. Now, anyone really can pick up an iPhone or a Samsung Note or any of the digital cameras that are out there and take technically acceptable photographs. The adverse effect that this has had for artists and professionals is that technically acceptable has become good enough for a lot of uses that we used to get hired for. Good enough for stock, good enough for public display, good enough for weddings. All those business opportunities that used to be there for people who had really worked on their craft and who were part of, I won't say an elite group, but a smaller group for sure. All that work now, at least in the eyes of those who are willing to pay something for it, very little, but something for it, that can be done by anyone because technically acceptable has just become acceptable. So our value as artists and professionals has diminished, as well as our ability to support our families doing photography. It's funny, when I was working in an editorial office right out of college, so you know, that was a while ago, but then, you know, the stuff that I could do couldn't be done by just anyone. And so my employer paid me money to do it. And that include writing, that include typesetting, you know, doing the layout, that include the photography, not only taking the pictures, but, you know, developing them and printing them in the darkroom, all that kind of stuff. I was able to get out of college. I had some experience, but I was able to get out of college and get a job right away doing the very thing that I loved. Now, years later, with the experience that I have, tons of experience that I have, there aren't as many people who are interested in that type of work than there was when I first got out of college. In other words, I was more marketable as a 20-something-year-old right out of school than I am now after years of experience, numbers of books published, all that kind of stuff. that is the evolution of things. And that whole devaluation is having an impact on people who are trying to make a living doing this. In other words, we have to look for other ways to make a living. Well, boo-hoo, right? Because there's a lot of other people who are having their jobs replaced also. So in a lot of ways, this is just the march of progress. And we're caught up in it just like everyone else. But then there's one more thing, and this is number six. We're talking about life after September 11th, 2001, which is interesting that that date is coming up again real soon. So while all these other events are unfolding, the effects of 9/11, I think, are continuing to surface and to some degree even expand. So now practically anyone taking a picture in public may be subject to questioning by security guards, pedestrians, shop owners, and even the police. And what's interesting about this is that, to my knowledge, photography did not play a role in the horrific attack by terrorists. Yet somehow it has suffered collaterally ever since. People just aren't the same in public. And I'm not saying it's all 9/11. There's a lot of other things going on too, obviously. But I sort of felt the change happen after 9/11 in 2001 and actually have felt it grow since that time. And I would say that today, in my opinion, hostility toward photographers is at an all-time high, at least during my career. I have not seen anything like this. The incident that I told you at the top of the show about the man at the Metro Rail station, that has happened to me dozens of times in one form or another. And even the other day, my son was telling me a question because he had flown out to Utah on summer break. He's a kid. He had cheap tickets, so he's in the back of the plane. So he's trying to make the best of, you know, what's normally not a good situation, being stuck there in the back of the plane next to the restrooms. And he sort of noticed, looking forward, that it was kind of a neat shot. You had the whole plane in front of you with the backs of people's heads and, you know, the whole sort of environment there. So he thought, okay, I'm going to take a picture. This is a neat shot. And I'm thinking, that's so cool, you know, that you saw that shot. So he takes a shot, and then just moments later, one of the flight attendants, walks up to him. And she goes, "Did you just take my picture?" In a very aggressive manner. "Did you just take my picture?" Very much like what I heard out at the Metro Rail. And he's going, "I wasn't taking your picture. I was taking a picture of the whole scene here." And he actually showed her the shot. Yes, she was in it. She was walking down the aisle. She was probably about halfway through the frame. But the shot wasn't about her. It was about, you know, the environment that he was in. She saw the shot, and she wasn't really satisfied with his explanation, and she turned and walked away from him. And that was it. You know, no apology, no resolution at all, just this sort of hostility. And he told me that story because he was kind of unnerved by the whole thing. And I had a lot of empathy for him. I had a lot of empathy for him because I know exactly what he had just gone through there. And the only thing that I could tell him is that this is kind of the way the world is right now. In my case, because photography is so important to me, it doesn't stop me from taking pictures, but I do think about it more before I pull out the camera. And sometimes I know that I'm going to maybe have to deal with someone after I capture the shot. And it's probably going to be the same for you too. Whatever this is, whatever the convergence of what's happening to us socially, I think started with September 11th, 2001, which was, I think, the intent by the terrorists who launched that attack, and is part of the mix of whatever it is that we're all dealing with these days. So where does that leave us? If we're not careful, we could find ourselves in a wholly unsatisfying position, where on one hand we have these marvelous tools, yet the world that we have to use them in is highly suspicious, inwardly facing, and satisfied with the average. So I've had to have a talk with myself once or twice about this. And where I've come out is that as artists and professionals, It's our role not to be content with the status quo on this, to push back against hostility, narcissism, and mediocrity. So I was back on the streets the next night in Santa Monica. The image that I captured on that second shoot featured a young mother holding her child and looking up at the lights and the magic of the carnival atmosphere of the Santa Monica Pier. She was clearly happy to be there. She was enjoying it with her daughter. At that moment, life was good for all of us. As one viewer commented on Instagram, "I can't stop looking at this picture." So for me, that shot represented the good things about my photography today. I captured the image handheld. I didn't have to use a tripod, and I was able to stop, you know, whatever minor motion there was. And that's because I could shoot at ISO 3200 with a small camera with an aperture of f1.8. I could process that capture in great software. And then I was able to share it with the world that night on Instagram and share those good vibes with other people. So those are my positive takeaways of the state of photography right now. My feeling is I'll just deal with the other things as they come up. I'm going to hang on to the things that I think are good, and I'll just deal with the other stuff as it comes up. So photography has changed greatly since my first podcast in 2005. And there are definitely some things I miss from then. But like the image of my boys playing basketball that I captured with a Canon Rebel XT, I will always have those pictures. And at the end of the day, having those pictures is what makes it all worthwhile. All right, just a few updates here on our special 600th show anniversary. Woohoo, right? Okay, so big thanks to our Patreon members. I'll tell you, when we talk about good things that have happened online, Patreon is definitely one of them. Our members are one of the good things that's definitely happened to this podcast. I thank each and every one of you for helping to support this show. And I don't know if I have another 600 in me, but I'm going to go as long as I can. I'm going to tell you that right now. I'm going to go as long as I can. As long as we can keep the lights on, I'm going to keep talking. And also, I want to remind you that our B&H and Amazon tiles are on thedigitalstory.com, which is also where the show notes for this podcast are. So if you click on one of those tiles, either B&H or Amazon, before you go shopping, go to the site. Then use search on those sites to find what you want and make your purchase. That purchase, or part of that purchase, will help support the show. And that is a really cool thing. Also, doesn't cost you a penny more. And finally, be sure to visit our friends at Red River Paper for all of your inkjet supply needs. Paper, ink, envelopes, glassine sleeves, tutorials, reviews. If you're thinking about buying a new printer, make sure you go and check out the reviews. Just about anything you need in the world of inkjet printing, they can supply for you on their site. They have a tile on all the pages of The Digital Story, and they have a terrific Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. I'll be back next week with more of a regular show, and I think I'm going to talk about the neat things that are going on in audio right now and how audio can work with our images to create something really special. I'm going to give you some insights to what I've learned about audio while doing this podcast and learning videography. And I think I'll just make it a really informative and hopefully fun show for you. Have a great week. I'll see you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.